and Paco Villarroya.
Well, I don't recall having talked about that subject myself, but there's some likelihood that you may have heard a talk of any of the collaborators. It's not completely new what I'm talking about. I joined this case. I apologize for the repetition. I'll talk about the bilinear T of one theorem, and let me first start introducing you the linear T of one theorem. So we work in one dimension, in R. You can do the same thing in higher dimension, but I have nothing right now to say about higher dimensions, so let's work on R. And R has two lovely groups, the translation group. So a function on R can be translated. And a function on R can be dilated. Okay. And if you have an operator, and say it initially is defined on the Schwartz space, so mapping to tempered distributions, then such an operator could be invariant under these symmetries, okay? So you would have T composed Ty equal Ty composed T, and D lambda composed T will T composed D lambda. And it turns out there aren't actually terribly many of such operators. There's the identity operator, which is certainly commuting with those symmetries. And then there's the Hilbert transform. So the general operator would be a linear combination of the identity operator and the Hilbert transform. Okay, so the Hilbert transform is defined principal value of convolution with 1 over T. And you see that, well, the Hilbert transform has a LP theory, so the Hilbert transform is bounded in LP spaces. So you actually see there's and that's maybe the heart of Calderon-Sigmund theory in some ways, if you wish, that you have an operator that's very rough initially, and it just satisfies translation and dilation invariants, and then you can say a little bit more. You can say that it's actually bounded in LP. Note that these LP spaces also have symmetries under translation and dilation. So why is that? Well, just to remind you, if you have a translation invariant operator, well, if you have such an operator, then yeah, there's a Schwartz kernel theorem that's given by a Schwartz kernel, and then you can discuss properties of the Schwartz kernel coming from here. So if you have translation invariants, then the operator has to be a multiplier operator. So you have this function. The Fourier transform of F is just multiplied by a function to get the Fourier transform of TF. And if you have, in addition, this dilation, then the function actually has to satisfy a dilation symmetry. So you have a function on R that's invariant when the scaling. So it can only have, it has some value A. Well, it has two values, one on the positive half axis and one on the negative. This is just under positive scalings, okay. And then you can see how this is a two-dimensional space, and the Hilbert transform corresponds to the signum with correct normalization. So now, this is a bit of a boring theory, so just demanding those two symmetries cuts you down to too small a class of objects to be terribly interesting. And the idea behind the T of one theorem, okay, the linear T of one is that you try to broaden up this principle by, instead of asking actual symmetries on the operator, you're trying to just put symmetric conditions on the operator. You want to have a large class of operators, but you want to have symmetric, you want to have put conditions on the operator that satisfy these symmetries, and then you see whether you can still prove LP bounds. Okay? So just just to make you appreciate the point, you see, even that condition that it initially should map what functions to temper distribution is not invariant under these. Well, certainly the standard estimate you would write down here is, so you, what you would do is Tf, and then you pair with another Schwartz function, and this tells you that this can be estimated by the Schwartz norms. There's some n, so that, okay, where these G alpha beta are the Schwartz norms, F alpha derivative of F x to the 2 beta, something like this, dx, okay, so this would be F alpha beta squared. So this is really the estimate that's behind saying T is bounded from Schwartz space to temper distributions. Now this estimate certainly is not, doesn't have these symmetries, because these norms do not have these symmetries. Now to rectify this, since we agree we only want to put symmetric conditions on the operator, we make a slightly stronger, we say S to S prime invariantly. And what we mean is, well, we just apply our symmetry operations on F and G and demand this holds for all Y and lambda, okay, so for all uniformly in that constant here, for all lambda Y, T of D lambda T Y F paired with D lambda TYG should be smaller than C, and there's a normalization coming from that integral here that you don't take too seriously. Sup alpha beta D lambda TYG alpha beta. Okay, and the same as F. Sup alpha beta D lambda TYF. Okay, just by saying that this should hold for all Y and lambda, now I have an invariant condition. So call that either this S to S prime invariantly, or call it, it's called weak boundedness in the theory, weak boundedness. Okay? So it's gotten a little stronger than just this estimate, but not very far away from here yet. So we haven't in theory started the theory yet. But it is written in an invariant way. Now you need more conditions, and further conditions will be on the Schwartz kernel, and actually of rather mild nature. So well, by the Schwartz kernel theorem, there's a distribution, and let me write it as a function f of x plus t k of x t dt. So that's really meant as pairing a distribution with a function, but it will shortly become a function. And it will be a function outside the diagonal, so say for t, for okay, let me not. Okay, you will see there will be, for people theory, there will be a singularity. Let me not talk about this, okay? It's a technical thing. So, if this is the Hilbert transform, then K of XT will be 1 over T, and we know that kernel is translation and dilation invariant. So if we demand, we want K to be locally bounded outside T equals 0. So sorry, the singularity, so the way I write it, the singularity happens at T equals 0. So outside T equals 0, you want this locally bounded. And then simply by translation and dilation theory, you know, see that this has to be bounded by a constant over T. Because if it's bounded by a constant at some xt, then you can apply translation dilation to get a bound everywhere, and it has to be this one, because that's the one that the bilinear, that the Hilbert transform has. Okay, so that's just local boundedness, and in an invariant way under the group, right? And that's really everything. And that's a very mild assumption on the kernel. And turns out that's not quite enough. You need more regularity on the kernel to have any good theory. So you go to one derivative of K, the gradient, and then the dilation and translation invariant. The only translation dilation invariant you can have is this one. Okay, so those two together are all the regularity we need. Actually, we don't need that much regularity, it turns out. We only need some kind of Hilbert regularity. So we'll replace that strong thing by K of X prime T prime less than XT minus X prime T prime. So this is gamma Hilbert regularity. And that only needs to hold if that's less than 1, okay? That's a condition on xt and x prime t prime. Okay, so that's weaker than that. And we will only need this for arbitrarily, for any small gamma that you wish, okay? So that's local Hilbert. And again, the right-hand side is simply determined by us wanting this to be translation and dilation invariant. There's no other signature on the right-hand side. Yes?
That's
what you
want
to have
lambda
T
y x along with the
right-hand side. Where are you? That's right. One place I should get rid of that. Yeah, one of the two places. Okay, so these are the standard Calderon-Sigmund conditions. You could even have something weaker than that. Okay, there's a Hermander condition. But that's actually too weak for our purpose, so let me not go into that. That works for some instances, but for what we want to do. So now those two together, well, we are aiming at a set of conditions that will apply LP boundedness, and those two together don't do this yet. You need something, slightly stronger. Which is called restricted boundedness, and which is, what we want to do, we really want to go from this very weak regularity to LP to LP, or L2 L2 first. And what we'll do, we'll go halfway. We'll map S into L2. We'll make this an assumption, okay? So this is going halfway the way we want to do, and then we will conclude from there that maps L2 to L2. So we say Ts to L2 of R invariantly. Okay, and now it's no longer symmetric between T and T star, so we also demand that this is. And I won't even write down since I'm not good at it anyway, so it's this where one of those is replaced by the two norm, right? And what we really, what we try to prove is both replaced by the two norm. Okay, and then that's the theorem R. Originally, okay, T of 1 theorem, originally attributed to David and Cheney, though there's plenty reformulations of that theorem, so there could be a long list of people having done reformulations without not going to list that. Okay? So assume, let's put a star here and double star here. And restricted boundedness, then P is bounded in all LP spaces. Okay. And it's actually an if and only if. Well, assuming star and double star, then there's an if and only if between those two, which is pretty clear because, I mean, certainly in L2, this in L2 implies that clearly. Okay. So this is a nice extension from the actual invariant case of invariant operators to operators which satisfy a bunch of invariant conditions like these rather actually mild regularity assumptions on the kernel and some restricted boundedness, which is actually also quite mild if you think about it, because it, well, it's halfway from the trivial. Okay. Yes? Yes. So, but this way of presenting it doesn't actually tell you why it's called the T of 1 theorem. So let me tell you a little more about this that explains to you why it's the T of 1 theorem without relating the two. There's a toy model for this situation, and so I'm going to write something down that's not quite invariant under translation and dilation, but invariant under dyadic dilations, okay? And, well, some sort of dyadic, in some ways dyadic translations, okay? So the symmetries here are a little compromised, but it makes for a beautiful analytic model to study. So let's write an operator in this dual form, I mean TF paired with G, integral f of x, g of y, k of x, y, dx, dy. Again, initially in the distribution sense, if you wish. So I'm changing variables a little bit from here to here. So here the singularity sits on the diagonal, while here the singularity sits at t equals 0. Okay, so let me draw the kernel and the diagonal. So that's x equal y. Now I still want the kernel to satisfy k of xy is less than 1 over x minus y, or constant over x minus y. But instead of Hölder or differential regularity, what I'm doing is I'm drawing dyadic squares. So this is 1, and then I'm translating these squares along the diagonal, and then I'm drawing a Whitney decomposition
Okay, so you get the idea.
And I demand the kernel to be constant on these squares. Okay, so that's, as you see, as you go away from the diagonal, you get in some way smoother and smoother, okay, which is what this thing is telling you. And close to the diagonal, you have much variations. Okay, constant on these squares. And that same picture above the diagonal. So that replaces such a regularity assumption. Now, in some ways it's weaker than this because you have these discontinuities, but it has much more structure because it's actually constant on these squares, so we can actually write down. So what we can do is we can do a high expansion of this kernel. Okay, so what we need half functions, which are locally constant orthonormal basis of L2, if you wish. We need functions on these squares, so there's three. Okay, in one dimension you have the following function. You have a half function, hi on an interval I, which looks like this, and you have a characteristic function, which looks like this on an interval I. Okay? And if you take the half functions on all dyadic intervals, you get an orthonormal basis of L2. Okay? So I want always these guys in L2 normalized and these guys in L1, but that's a technicality. So in two dimensions, you have functions sitting on the square. So if you have values on those four squares, it's a four-dimensional space, but the constant function on this you can think of coming from larger squares, so you only need three functions of three mean zero functions, and these are three mean zero functions here. That can be written by tensoring these guys in the correct way. And doing this over all dyadic squares will give you an orthonormal basis of L2 of R. And in this situation, you only need those squares that are centered on the diagonal. Okay, so you can write this kernel as a sum, and then let me write it right away, TF equal, so there are those guys which are HI tensor HI, so you take F HI, F paired with HI times HI, and some coefficients, AI here. Okay, and then you have these guys, bi, f, chi, I, hi, and then you have some ci, f, hi, chi, I. Okay, so these are rank one operators corresponding to these basis functions. And any, okay. Now a kernel of this type can be written in this form, okay? So you get this nice structure of the kernel. So let me call this T1 here, T1F. This is T2F, and this is T3F. And now you can study boundedness theory of these guys. And the first one is completely trivial. Okay, T1 is bounded simply by Cauchy-Schwarz. Okay, you have an orthonormal basis here, and this is basically a multiplier operator with respect to this orthonormal basis. So all you need is that the AI be bounded. And T2 and T3 are actually formally duals of each other. Well, if you put the same numbers BI here, then these are duals of each other. So these guys are called paraproducts. And you only need to understand one of them because the other one is dual. But they have a more intricate theory. That's something you can't do just
Well, you just have to appeal to some through my big theorem, and it's okay. So T2 is bounded if and only if. See, BI is what's called a Carlson measure. And that's called the Carlson embedding theorem. Okay? And that's a somewhat deeper theorem, certainly, than the T1. And what does that mean, TI, some BI is bound? Some BI squared over all I subset of some interval J is less than the length of J. That's the definition of what the Carlson measure is. Okay? Now you see, this is the same as sum over all I, BI, HI, being a BMO function. That's simply by a dyadic BMO function, and that's simply by the definition of what dyadic BMO is. Okay, so this is by definition, and this is by definition. And this is now nothing but if you plug in for f the constant function 1, you pair with these characteristic functions, you just get a, and these are normalized in L1, so this is equivalent. The left hand side is simply T of 1. T of 1 is in BMO. Okay? So all implications here are trivial except for the first one. And then you see, okay, T2. And then of course, the third one is bounded if T3 star of 1 is in BMO. Okay? Now this adds a little structure theorem to those operators, okay? Well, only in our toy model, but this has a translation into the non-toy case. It has this decomposition into power product and some non-power product term, and it has some actual concrete conditions that something is in BMO. I'm not going to show you why this is equivalent. Let me just mention that this is also how you actually prove the real T of 1 theorem. So let me make a little corner here about. So suppose, well, first of all, you can translate, okay. Okay. You could replace that by, okay, equivalently, T is weakly bounded. That's the thing I had at the very beginning. That's just S to S prime invariantly. You need to start with something. And T of 1 in BMO and T star of 1 in BMO. Okay, so that you can replace one bubble by the other bubble and have an equivalent. The way to show is actually you show those two are equivalent, and then the big step is to go from here to here. And you need to argue a little bit. One is actually not a Schwarz function, so you have to argue why you even have that, but let's not go into this. Now, if you want to prove that T of 1 theorem, you go to the second bubble, and then you have T of 1 is some function in BMO, and T star of 1 is some other function in BMO. The first thing is you subtract, you produce your favorite power products that you then estimate by the Carlson embedding theorem and subtract them from here. Okay, so you have one power product, P of 1 is F and P star of 1 is 0, and you subtract T minus P, and then you have replaced that F by 0, and then you do this dually. So you have a T tilde equal T minus P and minus something else, which kills the G, the dual. And then you have this remainder T star, and you try to then mimic this kind of proof okay, with some kind of Kotler-Stein almost orthogonality. Okay, so and just for the sake of later reference, let me draw a picture here. Xi eta. So this is a frequency picture, and think of this as plotting f hat in this direction and g hat in this direction. So these are the. So t of 1 is in BMO. If you take the Fourier transform of 1, you get the Dirac delta. Well, that's not quite. You get the Dirac delta. So this condition tells you in the frequency plane somehow that you're vanishing, something is vanishing along this line. Okay, that's if you have a Dirac delta in this direction. And then the other one tells you something is vanishing along this line. And once those are vanishing, then you have some almost orthogonality. And what you could do is you could decompose in Xi and in eta in a Littlewood-Paley decomposition. So you look at these frequency bands. Okay. So a square here would come with an I and a J. And what the square would mean would P apply to, you know, some projection operator PI applied to F. And a PJ applied to G. Okay, so that's what this picture really means. Now, if you take a diagonal, then you have enough orthogonality between these frequency intervals. You can actually just mimic such a argument without any Kotler-Stein. And then what you could be doing, some kind of lacunary cones away from the axis. And for each cone, you have an object like this. And there, you can try to bound them all uniformly, but then you have to somehow sum this up. So you have to use something as zero here, and something tends to zero here. If this is just hand waving, there's nothing precise here. If you have such a condition here, you can show that these cones actually get smaller and smaller operators as you tend to the axis. Okay. So that's just how one way of looking at this. Okay. So this is what I wanted to say about the linear theory. Now let's go bilinear. So bilinear operators is the same as trilinear forms. So if you have a trilinear form, lambda of FGH, you can always view this as a bilinear operator in FG paired with H. And now you see this guy actually has 6 dual objects, which comes about from permuting those 3 entries. There's a 6-fold symmetry group. Okay, so compare with just the 2-fold symmetry group TT star in the linear case. Okay, starring means changing the role of the 2 entries in your bilinear form. And since 6 is a large group, it actually makes sense to formulate everything symmetrically as you go to bilinear. Okay, in the linear case, you get away with not worrying about the symmetry group because it's so small, but you're well advised to always use trilinear forms in the bilinear theory. Now, by the Schwarz kernel theorem, okay, suppose FGH are Schwarz functions and any bounded trilinear form will be an integral. Well, FG H of Z with some 3-dimensional kernel x dy dz. Okay. Now you see. Now you have actually a 3-dimensional object here. And you only still have just, we're still looking at the two symmetries of translation and dilation, lambda of PYF, PYG, PYH equal lambda of FGH. Okay, so let's do the same thing as before. Let's first look at operators who actually do have invariances like these, and then we'll replace actual invariance by just invariant conditions on the operators. DYF would be lambda F, D lambda G, D lambda H. Okay, and now you need this again coming from the integral here. Lambda of F, G, H. Okay. Or as a lambda inverse that just is there for naturally. So this is a two-dimensional symmetry group on three-dimensional kernels. So this is not going to nail things down just to a finite-dimensional space. There's still one dimension left. Now the translation symmetry, you can write a multiplier operator, this is multiplier form, so you could write lambda equal integral xi plus eta plus kappa equals zero, f hat of xi, g hat of eta, h hat of kappa, m of xi eta kappa, okay? It's just taking the Fourier transform of this and using the translation symmetry means that this multiplier is supported on the hyperplane, so we have a two-dimensional picture. It's more properly drawn like this. Xi eta kappa. Now, a dilation symmetry means that we are constant on rays. And you see there's still a one-dimensional degree of freedom. You can choose anything on that circle. Now there is a classical theory when you demand the function on this circle be sufficiently smooth. Okay, say smooth outright. Then you have a theory, a multiplier theory here, and you have actually also a T of one theorem. So that's a, you know, demand this symmetry, demand the multiplier to be smooth on that circle. Then first of all, the operator is bounded in LP. Okay, so that's the invariant theory. And then you can loosen this up, replacing those conditions by things that look more like the T of one theorem, and then you have a bilinear T of one theorem. And I believe due to my Chris, but I may be mistaken here. So that's not the bilinear T of one theorem I'd like to talk about. I'd like to use this one degree of freedom. I would like to kill this one degree of freedom in some different way, by just imposing one more symmetry on the object, and that's a modulation symmetry. So modulation, to remind you, is multiplying of the function m eta f x is f of x e to the I eta x. And it does correspond to a translation of the Fourier transform of f. Now what you can do is you can fix the vector alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, R3, better not be 0. And then you can impose a modulation symmetry, M alpha 1 eta F, M alpha 2 eta G, M alpha 3 eta H, equal lambda of F, G, H. Okay, you could demand this for all H. So that's the one parameter symmetry group that makes it then a three-parameter symmetry group. So what's that symmetry group in this picture here? If you actually have that, then there's a vector here, alpha, which you should think of as sitting in this plane. Let's just put it in this plane. So alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus alpha 3 equal 1, equals 0. If you wish, you can even have alpha normalized to norm 1. So there's now a translation symmetry on the frequency space. Okay, and you have a three-parameter symmetry group, then this should nail things down to a two-dimensional space, and it does. So what you do is you draw a line through this vector, and then you have to be a multiplier that's invariant under translation in this line, and you also have to be invariant under scaling, and this can only be if you are constant on those two half planes. Okay, so you're back to a two-dimensional space. And the two-dimensional space, okay, if lambda has this, then lambda equal either, well, there's no identity operator here, but there is the point-wise product, f times g times h dx, okay? So that's, if you have a constant one multiplier, then that's the object you get. It's just the product fgh integrated, plus b, and then what's called the Bilinear-Hilbert transform, okay? B times the Bilinear-Hilbert transform. It's really the trilinear, the corresponding trilinear form. Okay, so the Bilinear-Hilbert transform is a multiplier operator that's constant on two half spaces. So where does this modulation symmetry come from? Or what's the natural appearance of this modulation symmetry? Well, first of all, there is not one modulation symmetry. There is plenty modulation symmetries. Okay, so basically you're choosing a vector alpha on the unit circle in that plane. Now, there are a few degenerate cases, or there are degenerate cases when one of these alphas is zero. Then something bad happens, which trivializes the thing. I'll probably get to this later. So there's three lines, okay, where alpha is zero. And those should be excluded from the generic theory. And then there's plenty other choices of alpha where none of the entries is zero. And there's a choice. There's not really any of these better or worse than the others. Now, where would you pick up such a modulation symmetry? Now, actually, not anywhere in PDE. I mean, Calderon sigmoid theory really arose from studying PDE, and I have tried to find this modulation, any such modulation symmetry in PDE, and I haven't. So it doesn't come from there, except the degenerate ones. The degenerate ones have been observed to appear in PDE, but they are not the ones where I have something useful to say about. But these modulation symmetries do appear, as I learned, in ergodic theory. So ergodic theory is doing things while it's looking at multiple recurrences. So you have some kind of measure preserving map, and then you look at TNF and T2NF and T3NF. You do such things. And once you have done such a thing, you have chosen a vector 1, 2, 3. So now you have broken the symmetry. You have done the symmetry breaking that needs to be done to specify a vector in here. And then if you look carefully, you can find the modulation symmetry. So these, you know, much of what I'm saying has been of interest in ergodic theory, and it hasn't been much of interest yet in PDE. But that's... So let me quickly try to get, how much do I have? I guess I did start a little late. I will try to be done by the hour. Okay. So let me write down, okay, so the bilinear Hilbert transform, let me write down what that is, lambda f g h, and I'm writing back on the kernel side, f of x plus beta 1 t. Now you're taking the Fourier transform of some vector alpha, so beta is a vector that's perpendicular to alpha and 1, 1, 1. Okay, so that in beta also lives in this plane here, but it's perpendicular to alpha. And you write down the following, f1, f, let's do it f1, f2, f3, f1, f2, x plus beta 2t, f3, x plus beta 3t, dt over t dx. Okay, so that is, this is the bilinear Hilbert transform. And then a theorem by Lacy and myself shows that this is bounded. So this is sort of the analog to the Hilbert transform that I had at the beginning, okay? So there's this C F1 P1 F2 P2 F3 P3 and 1 over P1 plus 1 over P2 plus 1 over P3 equal what? And where, okay, now I have some, I also need some inequalities in P1, P2, P3. Let me draw a picture. Let me draw a picture of this plane, sum of reciprocals equal 1. So that plane has a natural threefold symmetry. It does contain the points 1, 0, 0. So that would be L infinity, a 1. And then the permutations 0, 1, 0 and 0, 0, 1. So inside this inner triangle, that's the region where all three exponents are positive, which is something you want if you write this down. And except for those endpoints here, except for the corners, you have estimates everywhere. Okay, so that's one smaller pi smaller equal infinity. That, however, is not the end of the story. You can actually go beyond that region. Towards a point here that is, let's see, let me, a half, one minus a half. Now a negative P makes no sense. I don't know how to make sense of this, but I know how to dualize it. So say if P3 is negative, okay, like here, say if P3 is negative, then this doesn't make sense. But what we can do is we can dualize, then P3 prime is actually bigger, is positive, and less than 1, where 1 over P3 plus 1 over P3 prime equal 1. And you can dualize this, so you could write down the bilinear operator F1, F2 in P3 prime norm is less than constant F1, P1, well, F2, P2, okay? Now such a thing makes perfectly sense even if P3 prime is negative, and that's how you should understand. In each of these here, P3 is negative, P2 is negative, P1 is negative. So this is how you should understand me extending the region to this hexagon, okay? And this hexagon really is just this point and the six-fold symmetry group acting on it. So this point corresponds to L2 cross L1 into L2 third. And the boundary of this hexagon is not part of my estimates, of our estimates, so you have to take the interior of that, okay? It is not known whether you can extend it to this triangle over here. Now what's the P of 1 theorem?
was for.
I'll just probably just write it down. Okay. Well, here's the modulation invariant bilinear T of one sphere. Okay, so what you do is you want, again, the translation and dilation symmetry that this object does satisfy in its own, you want to replace by invariant conditions along the lines. Basically, you want to replace the kernel 1 over T here by kernel K of XT, like you did before. You might also want to replace the modulation symmetry by a class of by conditions, modulation invariant conditions, but we don't know how to do that, okay? So what we do, we just keep, okay, 6 alpha, and let lambda be actually modulation invariant in direction of alpha. So we keep the full modulation symmetry in alpha. We don't wiggle with that. There's recent work by Frederic Bernicot. He's loosening up on this. On the other hand, he's weakening the rest of the theorem. So he's also not quite strengthening that. And then, you know, then you say lambda f dh equal integral f of x plus beta 1 t f2 x plus beta 2 t f3 x plus beta 3 t k of x t dt dx, where k satisfies star and double star. So these are the Calderon-Sigmund conditions on k. Okay, so for technical reasons, whenever the intersection of the support of the Fi equal empty, okay. Well then, lambda is bounded, lambda F1, F2, F3 is bounded by the product Fi Pi if and only if, now we like some restricted boundedness condition. Let me just write down, if lambda S cross L2 into C and permuted and invariantly again, okay, the thing I screwed up at the beginning. These are the natural analogs of the restricted boundedness condition. So that is the bilinear T of one theorem that we prove. Well, I haven't specified the range. So let's say initially two smaller pi smaller equal infinity. So what is that region? Okay, let's draw the same region here. So there's an inner triangle in here where this point is a half zero. So that's L2, L infinity. That's one of those. And what I'm claiming here is this inner region. And that's not the full story. Now what we can do is we can extend that region, though not to what you would be thinking. Moreover, it's bounded it's not only bounded in this region, but also now I need to copy that. Well, let me do it out of memory. So let me just put the point here. So there's a point here that we can prove, and then all six permutations of that, of course, and then there's a hexagon like this, and that hexagon in general is smaller than this hexagon here, and the point is a half, let's see, plus delta, a half, and then minus delta, and permutations, okay? Bounded in the convex hull, the open convex hull, wait, not delta, gamma, and permutations. Now what's that gamma? Gamma is the old, that's the parameter in the Calderon-Sigmund condition. Okay, so unlike in the linear theory where the range of exponents doesn't depend on that gamma, here we can only prove something that depends on gamma. And well, it's open whether that's just us or that's reality. So it's an open problem whether you can extend that. Well, once gamma reaches a half, you're fine. Once gamma reaches a half, then you reach the full hexagon and you don't go any further than that. Right? Well, let's put gamma less than half. That's an interesting case. Well, why is that? And let me just draw a picture on the proof. So what's happening is, remember I had this C eta plane in here. So here, I have C eta kappa because I have three functions. And I have a vector alpha in which things are invariant. So if I project down to the perpendicular plane of alpha, I'm getting a plane like this. Eta kappa. And now the restricted bound in this condition again translate into some conditions of this type. Lambda 1 1 blank is in BMO. Okay, so that's a dual object applied to 1 1, and that should be in BMO, and there are three conditions like that. Okay. And lambda of blank 1, 1 is in BMO. So that tells you that there's something vanishing on these axes. Now it would be lovely, we do define some power products and they are roughly as hard as the bilinear Hilbert transform, but they're, roughly objects that I would write down if I had time, but I don't. We subtract those power products. And then it would be lovely to have some kind of Kotler-Stein argument, but we don't. So the only thing we can do is we can do this other thing by decomposing in a lacunary set of cones each of these three vectors. Now each of these guys has roughly the strength of the bilinear Hilbert transform, so you apply bilinear Hilbert transform techniques, and they do this to each of the cones, and then you pray you can do this nicely uniformly and that somehow the symbol tends to zero as you go here. And what's happening, we don't quite get as strong uniformity as we would wish, which means we can only add this series if this tends, if the cones tend to zero rapidly enough, and that's the condition on the gamma, okay? So gamma, large gamma will make this cones go to zero faster, and then our estimates that slightly blow up here in this, in this outside region here are still summable. Okay, but again, I'm not sure this is us or this is part of the theory. Let me therefore stop with this nice opening.